Okay, tonight this is something which I think is, I would call this a secret, really. Part of the more challenging things when somebody joins or becomes part of the observant community is figuring it out, like, you know, different groups of Jews. So like when you become more connected to the Jewish community, or even if you're in the Jewish community for a long time, you have basic distinction of, well, you have, well, the obvious ones that everybody knows, which is Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, Reconstructionist, those groups, people have a sense of that. Then you have Ashkenazic versus Sephardic. Then you get another thing about Hasidic versus Misnagid. Okay, you know about those distinctions. Those are all the obvious ones. But I'm going to share with you a distinction tonight. What? This, I mean, somebody who opposes the Hasidic movement. Or you call nowadays, another term is called Litvish. You heard that term, Litvish, which means Lithuanian, but that was the country which where the people who opposed the Baal Shem Tov, who was the founder of the Hasidic movement, lived. Okay. These are all the obvious stuff, which of course you know, but there's something I'm going to teach you tonight which you do not know. So, and I want to, and the title of the class is Moshe. Was he a Chassid, Yeshivish, or a Torah Umada Jew? Okay, how would you classify him? Now, obviously, in a certain sense, he was none of the above because there was no Jews in that sense in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. But I'm trying to bring out a point. Torah Mada means Torah and combining the wisdom of the Western world, which is another way of calling basically called modern Orthodox. Another way of describing that. Okay. Yes. MG would espouse the Torah Mada, trying to integrate best of both worlds. Okay, so what I want to share with you is that something you may have heard about. There was a famous book banning. I'm going to show you a video about it with Rabbi Nathan Slifkin. Raise your hand if you heard the name Rabbi Nathan Slifkin or Rabbi Nathan Slifkin. You heard the name. Okay, so just going to, we got one. Dan raises his hand. Okay, beautiful. All right, so I'm going to, let me have somebody on Zoom to, 1 second. Okay. Let's have somebody on the Zoomers. Why did I get locked out? That's really ridiculous. Okay. All right, so let's, without further ado, I want you to, we'll start by reading the basics of the story when it came out. Okay. All right. Okay, so Alan, can you read the story here? The little box.
Dozens of prominent ultra-Orthodox rabbis are backing an international effort to ban a fellow rabbi's book, arguing that the works are heretical because they suggest the earth is much older than a literal reading of Genesis would suggest. The target of the campaign is Rabbi Nathan Slifkin, an ultra-Orthodox author known as the Zoo Rabbi, best known for his book and tours relating to his research on animals in the Bible. He's also written on wider questions regarding science and the Torah. In particular, Slifkin's critics object to his assertions that the sages were mistaken in certain scientific matters and that the world is millions of years old, according to a literal reading of the Bible. Slifkin's critiques argue the world was created in 6 days and is only 5,765 years old.
Okay, so this one came out in 2005. So I'm going to share a little video. So Bear with me. This is Rabbi Nelson Slifkin talking about it. He's this is recent, a couple years ago, in England. Let me just do a share screen here. Bear with me. Got to do all the share screening. Share screen. I'll do this. This. Share. Okay. All right. Stickers. Here we go.
Kind of generous introduction. It's really very wonderful to be here. My first time here in this magnificent shul. Now, as you may know, about 12 years ago, I got into a little bit of trouble when three of my books were declared to be a tiny bit absolutely heretical by three dozen or so leading rabbinic authorities in the Haredi world. And it was a source of great confusion for many people. What exactly was it in their books that was so terrible? There was a lot of confusion about it. And actually, what it really was, and it's not well understood, but I was relying on a certain opinion, perhaps not well known, that Jesus actually did rise from the dead and that he actually was the Messiah. I'm joking. Issues of dispute was number one. I was trying to accommodate modern science and Torah with regard to the development of the universe and life on Earth. And secondly, that I was putting forth certain views about the science of the Talmud in order to not have to deny what modern science discovers in other areas, in zoology and so on. And the reason why it was particularly confusing that many people were declaring my books to be heretical was that as far as myself and my own rabbinate and my own circles were concerned, not only was everything in my book is not heretical, it wasn't even particularly original. But basically, I was just repackaging traditional ideas that had been said by many, many people for a very long time, by Rambam, by Rabbi Samson of Baldersh, by many other people. So how could it be that the same ideas, which were seen by my group to be clearly true and traditional and authentic, those same ideas were so, to another group of very learned people, were so obviously false and heretical. So it took me a very long time to figure out what exactly was going on. Of course, there was politics involved also. But in terms of the conceptual issues, I eventually discovered is that, we're familiar with different types of Jews, right? You've got Ashkenazi, you've got Sephardi, you've got Litvaks, you've got Hasidim. But there's also another difference which is not well appreciated, but which goes a long way to explain many ideological disputes in Judaism. And that is the difference between rationalists and, very hard to come up with a good label for the other side, but we're going to go with mystics, even though it's not exactly the right label, but the closest I can find. So, what are the differences between rationalism and mysticism? So they fall into three areas. The first is with regard to knowledge. Rationalists believe that knowledge is ideally obtained by figuring things out, and that the human brain really is quite good at figuring things out. Of course, it's not perfect. People are definitely fallible. But the brain is a powerful tool, and certainly the collective enterprise of many different human brains, cross-examining each other, testing each other over a long period, or as we might say, the scientific method is a powerful tool for figuring out truths about the universe. Whereas mystics, on the other hand, are very skeptical about the ability of the human mind, even the collective enterprise of all human minds, to figure anything out. And they much prefer to obtain knowledge via supernatural revelation, which they maintain happens quite a lot. Now, how does that play out with regard to Yishma books? So let's take the topic of statements in the Gemara about the natural world. So there are various statements in the Gemara about the natural world that do not seem to fit in what we know from zoology. But Chazal, the sages of the Talmud, describe certain creatures that do not seem to example, they describe salamanders that are spontaneously generated from fire. They describe mice that are spontaneously generated from dirt, not from parent animals. So in that book, that's the approach of Rambam, of Hirschigen, and many others who say that as great as the sages of the Talmud were in Torah, but when they spoke about these matters, it wasn't based on supernatural revelation, it wasn't based on traditional Sinai, it was just based on what they figured out, what people back then figured out. Right? In the same way as nowadays, you know, let me ask you, is there such a thing as a duck-billed platypus? Furry animal with four legs for the lays eggs. Yes? Sure? You've seen one? You haven't seen one. You haven't seen one. Even I haven't seen one. I don't believe you've seen one. Why do you believe it? Because David Attenborough says there's such a thing. Right? who's gonna doubt David Attenborough? So back then also, as Hirsch says, they accepted, Pliny the Elder was the David Attenborough of that period. And he described these animals. So it's not Chazal's job to go and investigate, is there really such creatures? They accept whatever the experts of that day had figured out. Whereas in the intervening time, people have been applying their minds more and more to studying the natural world, and now we've figured out that these things do not and could not exist. So it's not a problem to say that Chazal were wrong, because their knowledge wasn't based on any kind of, purported to be based on any kind of supernatural tradition. It's just based on what people have figured out, and now we've figured out otherwise. Whereas from the mystical perspective, when the sages made statements about the natural world, it wasn't just based on what they or others figured out. It was based on supernatural sources of wisdom, Ruach HaKodesh or traditions from Sinai and so on. Whereas scientists who say things, that's just based on what they figured out. I know that's not a very reliable source of knowledge. One of my opponents famously declared at the other convention, said, these scientists who claim to know what happened millions of years ago, do they know what the weather's going to be like in 2 weeks' time? No, they don't. Actually, if they can't predict the future, how can we believe tomorrow what they said about the past? I never quite figured that out, I have to say. It's a completely different worldview, completely different epistemology, right? In the rationalist approach, it's all based on knowledge that's figured out, whereas in the mystical approach, it's all based on a supernatural revelation. So how on earth can science possibly compete with supernatural revelation? Another example, a related example, a couple of years ago, I was investigating a topic that's coming up soon. Right, so Pesach and Seder night is a
mitzvah to eat matzah. All right. What Rabbi Slifkin brought up to try to explain why he got in such hot trouble, when he was sharing the positions of Rishonim of the medieval Torah scholars, such as the Rambam, and then modern scholars like Rav Hirsch, about that fact that. While the rabbis and the Talmud's understanding of the mitzvot is from Sinai, but what they thought about salamanders coming out of fire was based upon, as he said, the David Attenborough of their time, which is that's a reasonable explanation, and therefore it was the best knowledge of the second century. We are now currently in the 21st century. Just like in 2,000 years from now, the things that we think are 100% scientifically true, I can guarantee you right now, will be viewed as false or partially false. Because if you know anything about the history of science, every paradigm that we articulate is always being replaced by a more accurate, but still imperfect, paradigm of the material universe. Correct? It's constantly evolving. We had Ptolemy's concept of the universe, and then you had Isaac Newton's concept of the universe, and then you got Isaac Newton, and then you have Einstein, and we have all these various scientific paradigms about what the reality is, and it explains more. But then another group of scientists will identify it's accurate, but it doesn't explain this, this, and this, and therefore a new paradigm becomes like quantum mechanics. And there's other, and so on and so forth. That is the history of science, okay?
Take it easy, Thomas Kuhn. We got it.
Okay, Thomas Kuhn, very good. You read the book. All right. So the question is, Rabbi Slifkin felt, or he, when he got the massive blowback, when he got put into Harem. Does anybody know the Hebrew word Harem? After you give it a handshake, what does it mean?
I don't know. My grandma would say it, like, not a good thing.
More than not a good thing, that is warm, but we can go a little deeper. What is Harem?
That's not good.
Exile, close.
Heretic.
What? You're excommunicated. You're excommunicated. You're kicked out of the community. So, or your his books were banned, and basically he was persona non grata in that Haredi world. Okay. All right. Is that clear now? He wants to explain that, and he was a little bit surprised by that because he wasn't quoting Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist. He wasn't quoting, he wasn't gathering, all the atheistic writers attack against Judaism. That wasn't the book. It was literally various positions from well-regarded rabbis from the medieval time till present about dealing with the challenge of science and the Torah. Okay, like the age of the universe, the age of the Torah.
Who does the excommunication? Since there's no
they just said. Well, they put out a ban and saying everybody should not buy the book. Now, by the way, what happened to his book as soon as 36 rabbis signed off on the thing saying you shall not buy this book? What happened to the book?
It became a bestseller.
It became out of print, and you were buying it. You were able to only buy it on eBay for $300. Okay, that's what happened to the book. So. What the story was, and the publisher caved to the pressure, left him, and then he went to another publisher who published the books, and he basically sort of like quietly left his Haredi world, and he walked into the modern Orthodox world where he was celebrated. Okay, so now, but he was like confused, like he was as he said in the interview here, he was like. He didn't really understand, like, what happened. He was, like, a little bit shy. He was, like, a little bit broadsided. He didn't know. He did not see that one. I did not see that coming. Because these are all, I mean, what's more Jewish than the Rambam or of Hirsch? These are people with, shall we say, impeccable credentials. And what he shared, what he was a sort of a personal epiphany for him personally, is that there was a divide, an unspoken divide in the Jewish world that he did not realize that he sort of like rattled the beehive. And that divide, and I'm going to reveal this to you tonight, you're on your own way, you're going to start to see things in a different way. I guarantee you that. You're going to see our own community in a way what people are not really sensitive to. Okay, we're going to do this together. Okay, that's our goal. So by 9:15, which is in 46 minutes, again, my promise to you all is that you will have a sensitivity of that there is literally two worldviews that are competing for hearts and minds in the Jewish community, which are both observant. We're not talking about the non-observant. We're talking about within the observant community, which have radically different ways of looking at the exact same thing. Okay, all right. So is everybody clear? That's our goal for tonight. 45 minutes. We're going to do it step by step. Yes, so let me just unpack it a little more. We'll get to it. Well, he is a rationalist. So he didn't realize that sharing a rational view to a mystically minded community, because he wrote for the Haredi community, and he published it, and he didn't realize that was going to be a problem. And then, he got slapped.
Are we going to talk about...
That's a very good... Melissa asked, how could you have not realized that? Because first of all, things are not so black... I use the word. Things are not so black and white in the sense that he had been taught in those yeshivas. He had read those works. There are people that are open about that. It's not so differentiated out. You know what I'm saying? I mean, he's not an idiot. So I don't know what, so. So apparently as he discovered, he said, I'm going to write a book and then I want to get kicked out of the community. I guarantee you, he did not say that was his goal. let's write a book and that will irritate everybody that I'm going to have to leave my community. He did not elect to do that. That was not his game plan, okay?
And he can join a reality TV show.
And he should make a reality TV. Ah, very good, Max. Full circle there. Make this into a whole one big bit. Okay, so, all right, so let's...
I have one question. Are we going to talk about how communities don't believe in dinosaurs?
We're going to get to that.
Okay. Thank you. This is had a dinosaur tie. What more do you need in a rabbi?
Exactly.
So, and Penny, if he's the zoo rabbi, what are you?
I'm just. I don't have a. I don't got a cool name.
Oh.
I used to be Penny the Guitar Rosenthal. That was my.
Last
time I had a signature name, I was a different identity.
I like that name. That's a great.
I was also known as the Sock of Schlock. All right, bring on the cheese here. Okay. Well, that was my schlock rock days. So I was the sock of schlock. That's it. The Jewish rock band. You can check it out, schlockrock.com. All right, here we go. So I want to if we have your sheet here, let's do this together. Back in the day. He actually just came out with his 40th album. My former boss, Lenny Solomon. Okay. Now. Let's have Max Sterling in your theatrical voice. Find it, share it. Okay, read us out here. Okay. Yeah. Okay, hold on one second. I'm gonna put you through the sound system so everybody can hear your dad.
I'm in. Hold on.
Using two words, using Judaism.
Huh? Two worldviews in Judaism. What is nature? Mystics and rationalists.
So our focus is what we're going to deal with the topic of how you look at nature, the natural world. Keep on going.
The difference between rationalism and mysticism. Penny, I feel like you are a biased party in this.
Okay. All right. So okay. So Max, full disclosure, everybody who knows me knows that I am clearly in one of the two camps, but I'm trying to share not only my own side, you should see another side, okay? But Rabbi Wiles does teach a class in Tanya, which is a mystical book. Go on.
The difference between rationalists and non-rationalists. Penny, you're showing your hand here, fall into several areas.
I first tried rationalists and idiots, but I felt I didn't have the reason.
You're being very fair, Rabbi.
Okay. Okay.
I'm team Rabbi Penny.
Okay. Let's go.
All right, enough business. I'll go.
Enough jokes.
Just
hit
the
nonsense.
Dad.
Rationalists.
This is from Rabbi Slifkin. This is not mine. It's from his book. Go on.
Rationalists believe that knowledge is legitimately obtained by man via his reasoning and senses and should preferably be based upon evidence/reason rather than faith, especially for far-fetched claims. Mystics are skeptical of the ability of the human mind to arrive at truths and prefer to base knowledge on revelation, or for those who are not worthy of revelation, on faith in those who do experience revelation. This relates to how, as we shall now discuss, rationalists see the universe as essentially following a natural order, and hence we can understand it via our senses and reasoning. According to mystics, the supernatural order is dominant, and thus truths about existence require revelation. The order of nature, rationalists value a naturalistic rather than supernatural interpretation of events and perceive a consistent natural order over history, past, present, and future. Mystics prefer miracles and believe them to be especially dominant in ancient history and the future messianic era. They tend to maximize the number of supernatural entities and forces. Based on that understanding, how would you understand this famous Mishnah? Midrash, damn it. Sorry. What is that?
Simone.
Rabbi Simone, there is no blade of grass which does not have a celestial constellation which strikes it and says to it, grow. As says in Job, do you know the laws of heaven or impose its authority on earth? The term of authority is expressed two verses earlier. Can you tie cords to Pylades or undo the reins of Orion? Breshit Rabbah 10:6.
Or you may have heard this midrash before. Basically, it's saying like this: that whenever you go out to the Central Park and you see grass, this midrash, on its plain meaning, is that it says that how is that grass growing? That there is individually a celestial force. There are other texts that say an angel and a celestial force that is instructing or hitting each individual grass, telling it to grow. Okay? All right? Okay. So therefore, every individual blade of grass is growing by command of a celestial force, ultimately, of course, being tying back to Hashem. Okay? All right? He quotes two verses in Job. Now, so here's my question to you all. If you're coming from a rational school of thought, how would you understand this midrash? And if coming from a mystical perspective, how are you going to understand this midrash? You're going to read this midrash in literally two different ways. What are the two ways? Who can step in and inhabit the rationalist school? How are you learning this midrash? We're going to go to people who are in live. Ilya. Okay. Right, we call it photosynthesis nowadays, right? Yeah. Right, so good. So that's it. So in fact, you'd actually read the pasuk. It says, when it says in Job, do you know the laws of heaven? So what the Midrash is describing is that the laws of heaven, you know, they believe in that era that the constellations until recently, until Newton, the way that the laws of nature were understood in time of was that the constellations had influence about the world. Now that's still true. For example, we have tides because of the gravitational force of the moon. We have, if without the sun's influence on Earth, we would have no life. There'd be no life. Okay. The right now we know that the constellations of Pisces and Orion, that has no impact insofar as the laws of nature has a gravitational, but there's no, it's not affecting, let's say, the circle of life of
except grass. For Mercury in retrograde.
Okay, how so?
I'm making jokes.
I can make jokes. Okay, So the bottom line is that they would say that this is how the Hashem is utilizing these forces to cause the grass to grow. Okay? He's using these, in fact, that would bolster their position. How the mystical side of this is, how would the mystic read this? There's an angel that is causing every individual thing to happen.
But Rabbi Penny, with that first thing you proposed, doesn't that sort of risk a clockmaker's sort of theology, in that, like, this midrash though says that, like, it's active, saying to grow it, and so if, like, through the laws of physics, wouldn't you risk sort of a clockmaker's worldview as opposed to a continued?
Okay, so the excellent question, Max. So Max asked me Akasha. He's saying, well, what he uses, there's a philosophy, there's a thing called the watchmaker or the clockmaker idea, which is basically viewing that God is a, what they call deism. Hashem basically, created the universe and left. He like a clock, he wound it all up and it goes, you just set it and forget it. All right. Now we also maintain there's a thing called, we have a thing called hashkacha pratit, that Hashem is, and we say, amachadesh betuvah b'chol yom tamid. Hashem renews creation every day. There's a active involvement. Okay, God's existence and will maintains the universe. So we don't. So Max, you are correct. This is not only this is this this matter does not depict God's total relationship to the world. This talks about how he's dealing with grass. Okay, how he relates to human. We're gonna get to that a little later. How he relates, does Hashem relate to a blade of grass and a human being the same way or different? According to say the Benjamin Franklin Clockmaker approach, or even going back earlier, Aristotle, the answer is yes. You're in the laws of nature, and that's it. Game over. Okay. Well, how will the mystical school get to this? Look at the same thing as was said. Basically, that there is a God is either is having an angel, or God is causing each individual blade of grass to sprout forth each time, every time, individually. Okay. He's not. Oh, he. Well, so when you say he's a, that's going to be another thing. When you say that Hashem is echad, Hashem is uniquely one. So there are Kabbalists that maintain that God that for example say that Helek Elokah Mimal. There is a literally. I even don't hate to say this, but there's a divinity or aspect of divinity in every, each person. I'm not sure are they taking that literally. It's, when you deal with the mystical works, they use a lot of non-literal things. That would take away God's unity. Because if you're saying God's one, but somehow he's also a man in 9 billion people, or at least Jews, that's not much of a unity. Because you're saying... No, it's everything is God. Everything is well, then they're now... So now we get to another thing. Then you're getting to anything called... Then you're getting to a thing called pantheism. That God and exist... All everything is within God. That's a pantheism. That's a good friend Baruch Spinoza who was put in Hiram. So you can't sit there. So I'm just saying these issues are not. We're touching on a lot of different issues, which are the right issues to talk about. But if you're not sensitive to these things, people say things all the time. They're not really understanding where they're coming from. So I just want to. I can't. The whole thesis. We're not doing it. I just want to get to a couple of points here. Let's keep on going, and then I'm gonna bring it practically. Okay, so I want to now bring the mystical school in, Michtav Eliyahu. The Michtav Eliyahu, Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler, he was Mashkiach Ruchani of Gates and Yeshiva, which is a Haredi Litvish Yeshiva, but Litvish also means also mystical in a sense. And this is very much read. People read this, learn this together. And this is one of the works that are read. It's very common. So Max Sterling, keep on going. You're the reader tonight because everybody right. Can hear your mellifluous voice.
The highest level is to see nature not as a tool of God, but as a representation of God himself. It is not that matters are controlled by nature, which in turn is controlled by laws, which in turn are powered by God. God is present at every stage of the process. This is not, heaven forbid, to imply a position of pantheism or Spinoza's position that God is nothing more than a synonym for the laws of nature. It is not that God is really nature. Rather, nature is really a concealed representation of God. He is not using tools.
Okay. So when something's happening, Hashem is doing every single thing. So he wants to pantheism because he's what they call another category called panentheism, which is that God is somehow separate from the universe, but somehow inhabits the universe as well. I think we're gonna, you'll have to Wikipedia this later tonight. Okay, so just to put very simply, I want to just take one part of this. Basically, there's another. I'm gonna add another term. You're getting your PhD tonight called occasionalism. Occasional means that every event is Hashem doing it, or that Hashem sustains and governs through direct intervention. Every little thing. Blade of grass, Hashem is doing that action. Every little thing. Now, where does this come to sound like on the, that's a very nice graduate school philosophical talk. Very nice. Let's bring it down to practically. Let's get down to the thing. Okay. Based on this view, are there any chance or coincidences in life according to this worldview? No. Because Hashem is doing absolutely everything. Everything happens. Like I the fact that I dipped my piece of sushi and I picked it into that spice mayo, and I didn't gotta go for this. You know, it was, and it everything, God's doing everything, every little thing. There are no laws of nature. There's nothing. The laws of nature are an illusion. Okay, there are no coincidence. That according to this view, there are no coincidence. Everything is basically programmed. Now the problem with that position is free will, because that's not given. Could we say the famous statement in the Talmud that every single people knows that a kol bidei shemaim, of course, your shemaim. Everything's in the hand of heaven except for free fear of heaven, which is your moral will expressing itself to choose between good and evil. Okay, so there's a it's not given a lot of room in that kind of world, which seems very deterministic, because God's doing everything. There's no separate cause. Every little thing, God's the puppet master doing every little thing. So there's not leaving a whole lot of room for the Bechira. Now that's they have to deal with that problem. Okay. Did everybody understand that point? So everybody, how many times have you heard there are no such things as coincidence? That was Bashir. How many times have you heard that? 10,000 times. That position, relatively modern, is a position of the mystical perspective. Okay? Do you understand that? Because it comes from a worldview that Hashem, as he says, is not using tools. He's doing everything. Okay? That's going to be like the Baal HaTanya, the Mechtav Eliyahu, and many, and any, all Hasidic writings, the Chabad for sure, it's all for that whole worldview. Okay? Is everybody clear about that? So now I'm going to show you the opposite perspective. Okay, Max, read it out. This is the Rambam in the Guide to Perplexed.
Rambam. My opinion on this principle of divine providence, I will now explain to you. In the lower are sublunary portion.
It means the world below the world of the moon. They had a different, this is the Islamic world. Go on. In our world.
And how are we saying it?
Sublunary
portion of the universe, divine providence, does not extend to the individual members of species except in the case of mankind. It is only in the species that the incidents in the existence of individual beings, their good and evil fortune, are the result of justice, in accordance with the words, for all his ways are judgment.
Okay, stop right there. So the Rambam maintains that what we call hashkacha, divine providence, does only applies to mankind. But everything else is nature, okay? And when mankind, when something bad happens, we say, Baruch Dayan Emes, blessed is what? The true judge. Because as he quotes a verse in the end of Deuteronomy, Hatsur Tamim Polo Ki Kol Racha Mishpat, that all of his ways are just. So part of Judaism is to believe that what happens in this world, even though we can't necessarily see the justice of it, is ultimately, in the ultimate divine plan, makes sense. It's just, okay? That's the top of his own right. But that's so far. So therefore, nobody. Therefore, if an individual, something die, a person dies, it does not violate justice somehow or another. But in the rest of the, but all beings and creatures and existence, which is not humans, keep on going.
But I agree with Aristotle as regards all other living beings and a fortiori.
Which is Hebrew for kal vachomer, how much more so?
A fortiori, as regards plants and all the rest of earthly creatures, for I do not believe that it is through the interference of divine providence that a certain leaf drops from a tree, nor do I hold that when a certain spider catches a certain fly that this is the direct result of a special decree and will of God in that moment.
So that's literally the opposite position. So he says that was also a position of the dominant Shia Muslims or the Jews lived in North Africa. Maintain exactly that position, which is occasionalism. that if a particular spider got eaten by, caught a certain fly, it was a special decree and will of Hashem. Keep on going.
It is not by a particular divine decree that the spittle of a certain person moved, fell on a certain mat in a certain place, and killed it. Nor is it by the direct will of God that a certain fish catches and swallows a certain worm on the surface of the water. In all these cases, the action is, according to my opinion, entirely due to chance, as taught by Aristotle.
Okay, fine. So we have a very deep machlokas over here, very wide machlokas about what is happening in the world here. According to the Rambam, Hashem created the world in the 6 days of creation. Part of that act of creation was creating the laws of nature. On occasion, there has to be an override. We call that a miracle. The sea has to be split. The Jews have to be released from things. But generally, how does the world operate? Based upon the laws of nature. It is organized way. That actually reflects the beauty, the wisdom of Hashem that operates such in a profoundly wise manner. He is the author that's created the ultimate creation. Okay, that's what the universe is. Humans, there can be what they call hashkacha pratit. Now he limits that. It has to be not just, I didn't quote that, not every person every time. There could be a person whose life is basically left to the laws of nature, and that's not a violation of justice because that person did not merit any special help. You have to, in order to get God's help, extra help, you have to merit the help. It's not just like a gift. You know what I mean? In fact, and if you look at the Avot, they didn't expect it. When Avram went down to Egypt, there was a famine. Did he expect that Hashem was going to bail him out? No. He got bailed out. When his wife got abducted, did he think he's going to see his wife again? He wasn't sure about that. Hashem, every time you see it, he was surprised that he got what? Hashkacha pratit. This week's Parsha, Yaakov Avinu is going to see his brother for after 20 years, who left him in a murderous rage. Does he know? He said, well, I'm Avraham, I'm Yaakov. I'm promised to be a Jewish nation. I'm good. I'm golden. Did he think that? No. He prayed because he thought that maybe he's not going to get divine providence. So from his perspective, divine providence is a gift, not a guarantee. And he's the person who you think he's the most entitled. So he views the Avot's perspective on divine providence is that it's a tremendous gift, and you should what? Not assume it's, you should pray for it. Ain't no guarantees. Okay? I'll just stop right there. While the mystical thing says if God's doing everything, well, of course there's divine providence, because God's involved in divine providence individually on a blade of grass, certainly a person's life. You know what I'm saying? It's a kal vachomer the other way. If you're holding that God's involved with the life of the cycle of the blade of grass, certainly is involved in the, if every little action that you're involved with. You know what I'm saying? You see how that follows? Certainly the blade of grass, certainly you. Or conversely that, or if you view the other way, that God relates to the world through the tool called the laws of nature. And there is an occasional override called the divine providence, which only applies to men, and only mankind, and only under certain circumstances, which has to be earned. It's not like a guarantee. It's not like to say, from the wrong perspective, a guy pulls up to the pizza store and he got a spot right in front of the pizza place and it saved him having to walk 5 minutes is not an act of divine intervention. God is not reorganizing the entire traffic patterns of Manhattan so you can get pizza faster. First of all, the truth is, anytime you find parking in Manhattan, any time of the day, it does feel like it's a divine gift because it's just that fortunate. Anyway, so let's keep on going. Okay.
Rabbi Penny,
yes.
It was also striking in that passage to see the Rambam quote Aristotle as though he was a kind of authority. Was the Rambam sort of the first to introduce a secular source like that? So,
no, but he's the most famous for doing that.
Okay, interesting.
Okay, now I'm going to pivot. This is all really an introduction to our character, Moshe. Moshe is born. Let's keep on going, Max. Let's go to the story.
A man of the house of Levi went and married Levi's daughter. The woman became pregnant and had a son. She realized how extraordinary the child was, and she kept him hidden for 3 months. When she could no longer hide him, she took a papyrus box, coated it with asphalt and pitch, and she placed the child in it. She placed it in the rushes near the bank of the Nile. The child's sister stood herself at a distance to see what would happen to him. Pharaoh's daughter went to bathe in the Nile while her maids walked along the Nile's edge. She saw the box in the rushes and sent her slave girl to fetch it. Opening the box, she saw the boy. The infant began crying, and she had pity on it. It is one of the Hebrew boys, she said.
Okay. So, second. So here we have a very strange phenomenon. So the future redeemer of the Jewish people, where does he spend his entire childhood and early adolescence? He is brought up by Pharaoh's daughter, which gets to a question. Why deny Moshe the experience of raising in his own natural family, the best home in the Jewish people? Amram, his father, Yocheved, his mother, Aaron and Miriam, his sister and brother, and instead raise him in with an adopted mom of all people, the princess of Egypt. Isn't that a little weird? That here you have the person who's going to be the leader of the Jewish people, and he's brought up by Goyim, idolatrous pagan family. And he's denied being brought up. If you're going to have a divine intervention, let him be brought up by literally the best family that there ever was in the Jewish people. All three children, which is Miriam, Aaron, and Moshe, one of the three greatest prophets that the Jewish people had, and Yocheved and Amram, amazing people. He didn't get to spend much time with them. They visited him a little bit, but we have to assume the interaction was a little bit. He knew he was Jewish, but he was raised, you know, or he had the equivalent of the Egyptian Christmas tree. He had Christmas presents. He went to an idolatrous services as a child. He was raised as an Egyptian pagan, our leader. So the question, of course, is like, why would that be the story? It's just shocking. And how is he going to turn that all around? So this, of course, got the attention of the Rishonim. Okay, let's keep on going, Max. Let's do the Ibn Ezra.
Ooh, Ibn Ezra. The thoughts of Hashem are deep, and who can understand the foundational principles or various causes that Hashem uses?
All right, so pause there. He's saying that, like, the answer. He's starting with the answer is, this question is a little bit beyond our pay grade. We can't really know why Hashem's plan is organized the way it is. But having said that, perhaps
Hashem called Moshe to grow up in the royal palace in order that he should acquire a spirit of distinction and dignity through their training program and habits, and would not suffer with a low spirit of one who is enslaved. We see that he killed the Egyptian because his act of violence against the Jew, and he saved the daughters of Midian from the shepherds, since they were acting aggressively and unjustly by having their sheep drink from the woman's drawn water.
Okay, so according to the Ibn Ezra, what was the benefit to Moshe to be brought up in Paro's palace? Yeah, he was given a sense of a royal sense of esteem. He was like he felt like a player. In other words, if he was a slave, how would he feel? Like a loser, a schlepper. He'd have no, his sense of self would be completely crushed. So basically, Hashem, quote unquote, saved him in order for him to be the leader. What do you need to have? You need to have a spirit of dignity and of power and capacity. I could do stuff. So basically, the only way that we could have a leader is a person who was brought up in the family of leaders, which is Paro. In other words, that was the necessary core, let's say, DNA for Moshe to be Moshe. I'm saying that he would not have what they call a slave mentality, to feel depressed, to feel defeated, to feel like a loser. He felt like he's walking the corridors of power in Paro's palace. He's like the man. That's why a guy, he just kills a guy. You got to feel pretty intelligent to kill somebody. You feel doing injustice. Question. Chloe, then Stephanie. Okay. Well, this is, I'm just saying, you're right, but the challenges are of a different, but the question is, we're trying to go a step further, like, what is the benefit of this seemingly challenge, which is, would you on the surface, would be completely debilitated? So the answer is, yes, it's debilitated because he's brought up as a pagan, but simultaneously, on his emotional well-being, the sense of self and dignity, he was empowered by that. He also, you know what I mean? He became what they call, in Yiddish, you have schlepper, macher. He was brought up as a macher. And therefore, he felt that he was able to, when the role, when the time came for him to assume the leadership, he was the man. He walked into Paro's palace. The dude's not afraid. No fear. He's Mr. No Fear. And he doesn't even speak well. He still has no fear. Unbelievable. Question, Stephanie.
Yes.
That is 100% correct, and that is an idea that we're going to do the Ralbag. It's similar to the Ibn Ezra and similar to Ralbag, but they both don't mention it. But I think your idea is on point. So just I'm going to re-say it to the people because they couldn't hear you. We're not there yet. It's not 9:15 yet. We got a couple of minutes. We're not going to spoil the ending. So. So just to for those people who are in Zoom land, just to benefit, Stephanie made an outstanding point. There was a tremendous benefit to Moshe and by extension the Jewish people that in the world of politics, there's a phenomenon of, are you a political insider or are you a political outsider? And if you are an insider, you have a real knowledge of how things really work. If you're not really a person who works in Washington, you don't really know how things get done. It looks all kind. You have simply no idea. If you're inside, if you're in the what they call the corridors of power, and you're seeing how deals get done, you know what I mean. You're working with the top lobbyists. You're working with the top heads of the Democratic and Republican parties, and you're in the back. We call in the back room and getting down to the tachlis when the horse trading has happened. The deals are getting done. That is intimate information that only a few people have. Moshe was born into that world. So he knew how Paro operated because he was basically brought into the corridors of power and was brought up as an insider. It's a nice idea for Stephanie. Thank you. Now the Ralbag is an additional idea. We're running it. Keep on going. Max.
Rabbi, can yes. I just add, can I just say one thing?
Say two things. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. I was going to say just kind of to add to that. Maybe potentially because he was raised with that kind of background in the palace of Pharaoh, that upon receiving the Torah and being designated the leader of the Jewish people, he would have a greater appreciation for Judaism and would be that much stronger of a leader in terms of Jewish values and from, you know, that maybe he wouldn't have had otherwise.
Yes, in fact, that is the direction that the Ralbag takes, which we're going to now have Max reading, but Deborah anticipated. Very good. Dead, Max.
Moshe's Baal Shuva. That's good MJ material. This is to inform us the power of God's providence to his recipients of this providence. Hashem caused that the daughter of Paro would find baby Moshe and have compassion on him. And to rescue him. This caused Moshe to be raised in the royal palace and learn from the wise men of Egypt. This was a cause in his education of science and advanced concepts, which ultimately led Moshe to becoming a prophet. The ideas of the Egyptian elite, although incorrect, were instrumental in Moshe finding the truth. It also gave Moshe the confidence of an aristocrat, since he was spared the slavery and humiliation that occurred to his brothers. This empowered him to stand before Pharaoh and bring out the Jews from Egypt. This shows the nature of divine justice, as Pharaoh wanted to do evil to thwart a future leader of the Jewish rebellion from arising. Hashem caused Pharaoh to help grow, nurture, and develop Moshe into the future redeemer of the Jewish people.
Ends up with the called mida keneged mida, measure for measure. What is Paro doing? He is throwing the babies in the Nile. Why? He wants to kill their leadership class. What happens? His own daughter adopts one of those little babies, raises them, and becomes a future redeemer of Israel. It's sort of the ultimate justice. Okay. So what the Ralbag says is that really, that although he was brought up among pagans, he was also able to be raised within the court of royalty. What do presidents, kings and queens, what kind of education do they provide their children? The absolute best. You get the best teacher. You get the best education that money can buy. What did Moshe get? He had, the Torah talks about that Paro had in his court. He had chachamim. He had wise people in his court. So basically, he was able to learn from the wise men of Egypt, which allowed him to go on a spiritual journey, which he ultimately rejected their worldview, a materialistic worldview of Egypt, and on his own, I knew he was Jewish. Those two facts together allowed him to become ultimately to recommit to his duty to Judaism, explore that, and not fully clear how this exactly happened, but he ultimately becomes the ultimate prophet. But notice, and this gets, of course, to our scenario number one, Jane, reflecting on her life from MG, on her life before MG, feels regret. If she'd only gone to yeshiva day school instead of public school, she enjoys her class at senior fellowship and has a really fabrusa, but she still feels frustrated about her lack of basic high school Torah knowledge. Using the example of Moshe's experience, is Jane correct, incorrect, or partially correct? What do you guys say? Okay, why? That's true. And we assume if most people come to MG, what is their education? What are most people's education profile who come to MG by and large on average? What? No, secular. Yeah, nearly everybody here has, nearly every fellow has always gotten at least an undergraduate. We've always had masters, even PhDs, graduate degrees. So Jane, being the classic MGEer and senior fellow, is a highly educated person. So when you cannot, in other words, on one hand, MGEers always beat themselves up. They feel like I only got the Hebrew school. I have a hard time. I can't even read the benching. You know, they engage in negative self-talk, and they say, I'm just an education wise, I'm a Jewish loser. The point is no, because you don't really, you're forgetting the fact that you are a sophisticated thinker because you have 15 years of quality education, and then you are applying that intelligence, the wisdom and the perspective and that experience to Judaism at age 25, 30, 35, it's a different learning than you would have when you were 14. You know what I'm saying? You're coming at the material at a different age. When you have a lot, you're in a certain sense like Moshe. Moshe came to Judaism late in life. He only knew that he was a Jew. He maybe knew a little bit. He had the equivalent of, let's say, a Hebrew school education, whatever. He just knew a little bit about his background, whatever his visits to mom and dad could be afforded. But he was most of his time being educated in Paro's palace. But according to the Ralbag, he was able to leverage that education and allowed him to jumpstart to an entire new vista. So the fact is that many people who come to MJE and they're coming with their sophistication and understanding, they actually are able, yeah, they, yes, they can't necessarily read the text, but their understanding of the text could be substantially greater than the same guy who was a, who just has, they might be 35, but they're understanding it, it's still left in eighth grade. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because many people, if they're born religious, they don't re-examine the subject matter from when they learned it in elementary school or in high school. You know what I'm saying? They might be 35 years old, but Jewishly, they're really 7 or 17. Do you understand what I'm saying? In other words, their sophistication, didn't they have not applied their wisdom to relook at it in a sophisticated way. MJE, or especially those people who progress, fellowship, senior fellowship, are now, they're taking their experience and they're looking at the material as an adult who've worked, who's experienced, who've been trained. It's a different, it's, you're looking at the text in a different way. You know what I'm saying? The Chumash that Max just read is learned by fourth graders. Okay? And you can, so even if the best fourth grade understanding, you're not going to understand what's really happening here. Of we have Paro who's trying to cut a potential rebellion from its foundation, and then ironically, God's providence works it out that Moshe is into his system, his palace, nurtured, taught, given self-esteem, leadership skills, political skills, a sense of being a dignity of an aristocrat, and then he's able to, quanta rabba, use that to be able to become not just a Jew, but literally the ultimate Jew. The ultimate Jew had no yeshiva education. So I'm not saying, well, I don't have to learn, therefore, what you can accomplish later in life is more profound. Okay? That's what I would say to Jane. Question? Comments?
And I was thinking that when you learn it when you're younger, it for learning it and looking at it differently, and like older and after yes. year, you build upon that or different stories, pieces of it. So yeah, that's a
100% correct. Excellent, excellent. Okay, we have a few more minutes. Let me just okay, Stu. Stu was running late for a meeting. He was able to catch the subway and made it to the meeting in on time. He said, that was Bashirik. I made the subway. What would the mystics say and what would the rationalists say? What do you guys say? Alan, what would the mystics say about Stu making it and what would the rationalists say?
That Hashem used the train schedule in order to make sure that he made it on time.
Baruch Hashem. And the rationalists would say?
It's the subway. It runs every 8 minutes.
No, yeah, you got lucky. There is luck. You're in the right place at the right time, and you made the subway. And tomorrow you will not be in the right place, right time, and you will miss the subway, and that's just life. Ah, but then let me add a little kinach here. Let us say that Stu caught the subway and attended a Torah class that changed his life.
Well, the subway didn't change his life. The Torah class did.
No, but I'm just saying. But I'm saying that. So that already is that if something. So what I'm sharing, what I'm trying to point out is that there are certain situations in a person's life which could be subject to divine intervention. That's a whole topic.
Divine providence.
Divine intervention. Divine providence. So therefore, certainly a candidate for divine intervention is something that's going to be instrumental to your spiritual growth, not simply to catch a meeting, okay?
Look, we don't know if there was an angel pushing him a little bit faster onto the subway.
Correct, correct. I'm on the overtime. I got the, okay, last thing. This is a juicy question. Stacey, and I've actually dealt with this question many times. Stacey MGO was asked by her friend Joyner to get a blessing from a Kabbalistic rabbi. What would the mystics say, and what would the rationalists say? There are times there are people, rabbis that get blessings. That's like a kasha, but you can need a lot. You always need a extra mojo. I'm out of time. Obviously, you're going to have radically different views of that exact same scenario. One thing is going to be, well, of course you should go. One person, of course you should not go. So you're going to have two opposite views. There are many distinctions. What I want to share with you, I want you now, as you vision for, you talk to Jews, and you just hear what they say. And just put them, and just sort of, you can make them, you know, you could say, well, this one's Ashkenaz, one's Sephardic, but are they rationalistic, Torah mod-oriented, or are they more from the mystical perspective? Okay? And you'll start, as you navigate, you'll get a sensitivity, and you'll make you a better human because you will have an appreciation where people are coming from, and you'll understand what their worldview, and you'll know how to work with people better because you understand them in a way, in a certain sense, better than they understand themselves. Do you understand that? Because most people are not conscious of this. Because they're not really, they just pick up certain stuff, certain things. They don't really think it through. You know what I'm saying? And they're not knowing that there are different worldviews in Judaism. There's not one kind of, the key point is, there is not one kind of Judaism. Even Torah Judaism, you know, Orthodox Judaism, there are many flavors here. And as far as what they say about the universe is very radically different. That's what I wanted to accomplish. This is a mega topic. Rabbi Slifkin wrote a book called Rationalism versus Mysticism. It's an entire 300-page book. It's an extended discussion on this conversation. I recommend it. He brings down like tons of different things, how people relate to different areas. Okay. I'm now going to pause. Question, last questions, comments, anything.
Rapini, isn't it rational to like know you're sometimes irrational? Like, okay, maybe you know, you seek the blessing because you know in a rational perspective, it's going to give you the hope. You need to like keep going and do whatever it is you have to do to get whatever it is you went to the mystic for a blessing for. So like, you can't purely just be like a robot rational. Like even all those examples of our forefathers, like going through things on some level, they had to have some faith that it would work out. So
that's an outstanding question. Is it rational to be non-rational sometimes?
Well, rational to
know a little bit of a contradiction there.
But like rational to know your weaknesses in.
No, that's rational. No. Look, so Davy, of course, at the buzzer, you're asking a megatudinal topic. As I expected, it's a great topic, but I don't want to hold people. I will just say, first of all, it's worthy of another class. So I have to figure out. Oh, but we're having the show, which is the main segue here to the Shabbaton. We will discuss it. 5:30, we start right here. Before we'll have an hour learning, schmoozing time. We can talk about this topic, juicy topic, and we'll have FNL. Then we'll have a dinner together with my Marie and I. We'll eat in the blue room. It'll be great. It'll be fun.
Wait. It starts 5:30.
I mean, candlelighting is 4:16. 4:16. Right, okay. We're going to daven with FNL, which davens at 6:30. We're going to have a little clash, smooth discussion at 5:30.
Okay. Be there about 5:30.
I'm going to send this out there. I'm going to hand this out to everybody. I'm going to post it in the chat. Not in the chat. I'm posted in the WhatsApp, and look forward to having some time, everybody. Be able to make it. And I want to wish everybody a good night. I hope you found this illuminating, interesting, compelling, or